Hello and welcome to the Europeans podcast, coming to you from a very rainy and windy Amsterdam.
And Paris.
And Paris. Okay, yeah, I was going to get there.
No, it was just, I mean the whole windy and wet thing. I wanted to just clarify that it's those things here too, and cold. I feel like I have to stop my teeth from chattering.
We may have been annoyed about the wind and the rain, but some people in the Netherlands were really happy about it because when there's this much wind, they run a cycling competition for people to cycle into a headwind, which I thought was the most Dutch thing ever and also my worst nightmare. But yeah, apparently some people do it as an enjoyable competitive sport.
It's the perfect place for this competition. I once cycled on, I feel like it's the world's flattest island. Have you been to Texel in the Netherlands?
I've spent a lot of time on Terschelling, which is the island next to Texel.
Ah, I think they're both pretty flat.
They are, and both very windy.
You're like pedaling and just not moving. It's like you're in a spinning class or something. It's crazy.
In fact, it's the one time I've used an electric bike was on Terschelling, and it was amazing. I mean, Katie knows all about electric bikes. It's the family trade.
It is indeed. Should we give the family shop a free plug?
Yeah, go on.
Bushbikes.co.uk if you're in England or indeed anywhere else and fancy buying an electric bicycle, buy one for my parents. You're welcome, Mum and Dad.
Anyway, what's coming up this week?
Coming up this week, speaking of wet and windy, am I allowed to do that? We're going to Ireland to try and work out what happened in the election at the weekend. There have been some super interesting developments there, not least that it appears to have been a really good weekend for the left at a time when that has not been the case everywhere in Europe, not least in our own country. And we want to know why. So we've got the perfect person to unpick it for us, Naomi O'Leary from the excellent Irish Passport podcast. That is coming up. But first of all, we want to ask a little favour of you listeners. We're doing a survey to work out how we can make the podcast better and what you think we should be doing more of or less of, or maybe we should just stop talking altogether. I don't know.
Is that one of the questions?
Should we stop talking? If you've got 5 minutes, and it really does just take 5 minutes, please click on the little link there in the show notes and make your voice heard.
Democracy in action.
Who's had a good week, Dominic?
Well, Switzerland. You know, we've talked about how Switzerland loves a referendum.
They love a referendum.
They really do. They ask the public to have a say on a big range of issues every year, some of which, in my opinion, they shouldn't be politicising. Check out our interview with Flavia Kleiner from last year, Flavia and the Machine, for more on that. But the reason why we're talking about Swiss referendums this week is because they held two votes, and I'd argue the result of one of them is something to celebrate. The Swiss public voted to approve anti-discrimination legislation for LGBTQ+ people. The legislation is essentially an expansion of already existing anti-racism legislation, but it gives LGBTQ+ people legal protection against discrimination and hate speech for the first time in Switzerland. This law now means that, for example, if someone is fired due to their sexuality or even refused to be served in a shop because of their sexuality, the perpetrator could actually go to jail. So this is good news, and we've given them a good week, but should this have been a question that the general public directly vote on? Many people would say no, I am maybe one of those many people.
Because it feels like, why would you not want homophobia to be illegal?
Yeah, exactly. On a broader level, why should, this is my thing about direct democracy, why should the majority be having a direct say on something that is like a fundamental human right for a minority group?
Mm.
But yeah, okay, you ask, why would people be against this? So there was a group of right-wing parties that forced this referendum to happen after the Swiss government tried to pass this law in December 2018. Now, the arguments that these right-wing parties used in the campaign were mainly just about freedom of expression. They argued that free speech needed protecting and that this was essentially a gagging order. And they also took a rather original line saying that we shouldn't make out that LGBT people are a weak minority in need of protection. Mm-hmm. People didn't buy these arguments. The public were in favour of passing the law and 63.1% of voters accepted it. Vitally, the law doesn't include conversations between family members or friends, so people can still chat their discriminatory, homophobic bullshit to each other, and I guess that's the right call?
It's nice that they're not getting rid of the whole, like, racist uncle stereotype.
Yeah.
Sorry, homophobic uncle in this case.
So, yeah, people just shouldn't be homophobic, please, but I guess we shouldn't legislate about all conversations that happen in people's houses. That starts becoming a bit scary. Anyway, it's worth noting that Switzerland and Italy are now the last two Western European countries without gay marriage. So many Swiss campaigners are framing this referendum as a step towards that next big goal. Good week, Switzerland.
Good week.
Who's had a bad week?
Well, Switzerland may have made a bit of progress on the fight against homophobia this week, but I'd say it hasn't been a great week for the fight against racism across Europe. I'm talking about the way that some Europeans have reacted to the coronavirus crisis. At the time of recording, the virus has killed more than 900 people, all but two of them in mainland China. And the vast majority of the 40,000 people infected are also in mainland China. That's not to say that there's zero cause for alarm elsewhere in the world. Of course it isn't. Here in Europe, there are a handful of cases in several countries. Here in France, there have been 11 people confirmed infected. There's also cases in Spain, Germany, Italy, Finland, Sweden, Belgium, and the UK.
I have such an interesting mix of responses to the coronavirus at work. Quite a big divide between people. Some of my friends and colleagues are like, this is terrifying. We need to start stockpiling food and prepare for everything to shut down within the next few weeks/months. And other people who are just like, this is ridiculous. This is totally overblown. Seasonal flu kills more people. The death rate isn't that high. It's complicated to like know how scared to be about it.
Yeah. And I would say largely, you know, it's not like there's been like mass panic in the streets of Europe or anything. However, there have been a lot of reports of outright racism towards Chinese people living in Europe in connection with this virus, particularly in Italy. And thank you very much to our listener, Francesca Baldassari, for flagging this up to us on Facebook. There have been things like a bar in Rome banning Chinese people from coming in altogether. And the Conservatoire, which is this really prestigious music school, they have suspended all quote unquote Oriental students, which is all kinds of messed up. Here in Paris, I live in a very Chinese neighbourhood, and it's not like the place has become a complete ghost town or anything, but local restaurant owners are reporting that business is really down compared to usual. And just to give you one more depressing story, perhaps the worst of this kind that I've heard, the owner of an Airbnb refused to rent her place to one of my boyfriend's Chinese colleagues because she was worried about him bringing in coronavirus, despite the fact that he had assured her that he hadn't set foot in China for a really, really long time. I don't really have anything constructive to say. I just feel like we're better than this. You can dress up racism as like perfectly reasonable health concerns, but when it comes to like banning entire ethnic groups from your music school because of the way that they look, that's not being careful. It's just being racist.
Yeah, it's awful. I saw that the Italian president visited an elementary school that has lots of Chinese pupils as a show of confidence. And How are we in a place where that it feels necessary that a head of state has to show up at a school and be in contact with Chinese children in order to show that it's safe? Like, that's messed up, isn't it? It shouldn't be necessary.
It shouldn't. Do better, Europe. That's all I can say.
We've got an exciting thing to announce now. We've got a bunch of free tickets for gigs around Europe to give away. We've been given them by Live Europe, which groups together various super cool European concert venues, including Melkweg in Amsterdam, A38 in Budapest, Kino Shishka in Ljubljana, Music Box in Lisbon, the list goes on.
This week we've got three sets of free tickets for gigs by the absolutely brilliant Charlotte Dos Santos. She's Brazilian-Norwegian, glamorous combo. And she plays this really beautiful jazz. This is what she sounds like, just to give you a little taste. This is Red Clay.
Didn't really want it anyway. I didn't really
We have tickets available in Copenhagen at Vega on March the 1st, in Brussels at the Ancien Belgique on March the 6th, and in London at the Village Underground on March the 10th.
All you have to do for a chance to win is tag us in a tweet or a picture on Instagram, telling the world that you're listening to the Europeans and that you would please like a pair of these tickets. It's simple.
I said that we needed a hashtag, but Katie says that it's not necessary.
If you can think of a good hashtag for us to hashtag this under, let us know.
So we've had what I think journalists are meant to call a political earthquake in Ireland. Is that the right term?
We are calling it a political earthquake.
Good. Well, yeah, Sinn Féin, if you didn't hear, the left-wing nationalist party, have surged pretty massively to become the most popular party in Ireland, which is quite an extraordinary result considering that they had long been considered a relatively fringe party due to their perception as the political wing of the IRA. What does this result mean? How does it sit in Ireland's complicated political history? We have the perfect person to contextualise it all for us, Naomi O'Leary, Irish journalist and co-host of The Irish Passport, which is a wonderful podcast that can function essentially as your passport to everything Irish. Naomi kindly joined us on Monday night when some of the results were still dripping in.
Ooh, dripping. Just to get my head around it, and for people that don't know Ireland very well, mm-hmm. you have these two parties that are really pretty similar ideologically that have basically taken turns running Ireland since like forever, right?
Yeah, so Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are descended from two sides of Ireland's civil war. They're sometimes described as centre-right parties, but sometimes they don't like to be described that way. There isn't an enormous amount that separates them ideologically. To put it in really simplistic terms, Fine Gael is the less spendy and less godly party. It's more socially liberal, socially progressive, and it doesn't like opening the purse strings. Fianna Fáil is the more spendy and more godly party. So it has a traditionally conservative streak and it doesn't mind spending money.
I really like that distinction. It sounds like a BuzzFeed quiz or something. Are you more spendy or more godly? And what has changed now? Like, why are we talking about this election as an earthquake?
For the first time in history, a party has rivaled and actually beaten the two traditionally dominant parties. The left-wing nationalist Sinn Féin has surged into first place in first preference votes. And that's a sea change in Irish politics. It's never happened before. And it's extremely fascinating to see what's going to happen next.
When do you think we're going to expect all the results in?
Irish election counts are marathons. They go on for days. And this one will go to the bitter end because the result is so close. It's a system where voters get to rank candidates according to their order of preference. And when it comes down to close results, it comes down to people's fourth, fifth preferences being shuffled from one candidate to another, which takes a lot of counts and recounts, and it all takes quite a long time. But what we do have is we have some seat projections, which are based on how the counting is going so far. As it stands, it looks like the party with the biggest number of seats is going to be Fianna Fáil. They're on 39 seats, and just behind them, it looks to be Sinn Féin, the left-wing nationalist party, whose surge has been the story of the election. And then behind them, Fine Gael of Leo Varadkar on 36. So what those seat projections mean is that it will be really hard to form a government because all of those parties, even if two of them clubbed up together, they still wouldn't get to the magic number of 80, which is what's needed to form a majority. So then they need to look at probably talking to the Greens, who have had a good election and they've increased their seats from 2 to 12, or another of the smaller left-wing parties coming in with a handful of seats as well. It's partly made really difficult by the fact that two different parties have won the popular vote and the greatest number of seats. So Sinn Féin, for the first time in history, have won the greatest number of first preference votes. And they would claim that that makes them, you know, Ireland's first party, Ireland's biggest party. However, they made a blunder in the election. They didn't run enough candidates to capitalize on that level of popularity. They only actually ran 42, which is far short of the 80, you know, that you need for a majority. And that limited how many gains they could actually make. And that's why they're only coming in second in the seat projections.
This has been something that's fascinated me. The fact that they made this catastrophic error, Sinn Féin, in not fielding enough candidates. Is the assumption that they would have got many more seats if they had fielded more candidates?
The Sinn Féin candidates that were elected were often elected on the most spectacularly high first preference votes, so high that they could easily have brought along second candidates with them. So, they would absolutely have had a shot of being the biggest party in Parliament, for sure. But it's very easy to say that in hindsight. No one saw this coming. Sinn Féin didn't see this coming. They actually had quite a lackluster European and local elections last year. And that's why they decided to cut candidates ahead of the election, because they wanted not to split their vote. They thought that was the best tactic to try and make sure that they got as many candidates as possible. But they didn't see this coming.
So why is this happening now then, this massive surge?
In one way, it's a little bit of a mystery. And then in another way, you can look back and you can see this moment building for quite a long time. There's kind of two trends. The Irish electorate became sort of detached from its traditional voting patterns in the wake of the financial crisis in 2008. Fianna Fáil used to be the dominant party, and they were really punished in the wake of the financial crisis because they were blamed for the economic disaster in Ireland. After that, the Irish electorate has become very fragmented and quite volatile. And then the second story is that Sinn Féin has gradually been increasing its seats in Parliament in every general election since 2007. So they've capitalised on the fact that they broadened their party away from being a single issue party on Irish unity to becoming a left-wing party that's anti-austerity, that champions sort of socially liberal policies and so on. And they've also successfully completed a generational transition. Their old leader, Gerry Adams, who was leader until 2018, he was so controversial that he was once actually banned from the British Airways. His voice was considered so dangerous that he wasn't allowed. And now we have Mary Lou MacDonald. She's a Dubliner. She hasn't got any links to the conflict, and she's quite popular, especially among women. So that has helped the party to move away from a past association of being the political voice of armed struggle against British rule in Northern Ireland. You know, in the past, it would have been described as the political voice of the IRA.
I want to talk a bit more about their history with the IRA. There are presumably still people who would not consider voting for Sinn Féin. I mean, Mary Lou MacDonald has changed the image of the party to some extent, but how considerable is the divide amongst people you know, even?
Yeah, it would have been described as a Marmite party. And it was considered to kind of have a disadvantage in the Irish electoral system because it helps to not be controversial, to attract those second, third, fourth preference votes. And Sinn Féin was kind of a love it or hate it party. This election does seem to be changing that. I mean, if you look at the exit poll, it appears to be the most popular party among all sections of the electorate, except for the over 65s, which is really kind of sensational. But you're absolutely right. There's a section of the electorate who absolutely will not vote for Sinn Féin and who are totally spooked out by their success. And that's not an insubstantial number. It exists in all age groups. And yeah, of course, I would personally know people like that as well.
But I guess when you talk to young voters in particular, the troubles, does that really come up that much? Or is it more about stuff like housing and austerity and just broad left-wing issues, I guess?
Absolutely. This was the housing election. Housing was the number one issue, and Sinn Féin owned it by essentially championing a rent freeze and what they said would be the biggest public housing building programme in the history of the state. They were willing to propose radical change on an issue that, I suppose, especially young people have perceived the outgoing government of Fine Gael just to be not responsive on. They just haven't been able to get a grip on this housing crisis. So we're talking about exorbitant rents, people unable to kind of get a start in life because they're priced out of it, delaying families, even well-paid professionals living in bedsits that are really small and so on. It's so severe that it's actually affecting whole swathes of Irish society, you know, not just low earners. And Sinn Féin really capitalised on that. And yeah, you should not read this as being some massive surge in support for Irish unity. That is their defining issue. And the election happens in the context of the Irish unity question being more normalised in the wake of Brexit and increased expectations that there will be a border pull at some point. But primarily, it was economic issues that was driving this election.
As an outsider who looks at quite a few European elections, it seems extraordinary how much of a huge swing to the left there's been in this election, not only with Sinn Féin, but also with the Greens doing very well. Do you see it like that, or do Irish politics not quite fit into that normal left-right divide?
Irish politics absolutely don't fit into the left-right divide. So all of these parties, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Sinn Féin, they all have their roots in the politics of a century ago. They all came out of the struggle for independence. So they don't have the same traditions as left-right parties of the rest of Europe. It's kind of unique. Political scientists differ on how to categorise them exactly. I spoke to a political scientist just ahead of the election who said, actually, the Irish electorate is really left-wing. It's always really been left-wing. So Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have always had pretty economically left-wing policies in terms of like spending and stuff, even though we deny that too, you know, they're kind of believed to be centre-right. They're actually kind of more like centre-left parties. Sinn Féin are left-wing nationalists. Now, I know that sounds strange to many people, but we're more used to kind of right-wing nationalists, right, in Europe. It comes from the anti-colonial tradition in Irish politics and Irish political history. So they'd be very big on solidarity with Palestine. They would consider themselves to be an inclusive party. It's not a nativist right-wing populism like we've seen elsewhere.
Yeah, and that was a really interesting point that I know you made in your most recent piece for Politico. Like, this whole sort of nativist anti-immigration swell, we haven't seen any of that really in this election.
Yeah, Ireland continues to escape the trend which has been observed internationally of the radical anti-immigration right emerging and becoming a major force in politics. There isn't a radical right party still in Ireland. There's been quite organised and quite well-funded attempts to create one, sometimes backed by international forces that are interested in doing that. And we saw that in this election, but it's completely fallen flat. I mean, the candidates and parties that ran on a nativist anti-immigration platform did not make an electoral dent. And we saw in the exit poll that immigration was an issue only for 1% of voters. And that was a poll of some 5,300 voters.
What are the options looking like now for coalition agreements? I know that various parties said during the campaign that they wouldn't work with each other. So someone's going to have to compromise.
Very, very difficult. Both Mary Lou MacDonald of Sinn Féin and Micheál Martin of Fianna Fáil may feel that they have a claim to be Taoiseach. It's really difficult because if you look at the numbers now, the predicted seats show that even together those two parties wouldn't have 80. They'd need the Greens or somebody. And in the campaign, Fianna Fáil said, Micheál Martin said he didn't want to work with Sinn Féin. Now, he began to roll back from that as soon as the extent of the Sinn Féin vote was obvious. So it could happen. There are some people in Fianna Fáil who want that to happen actively. There are others who really don't want it to happen. The one thing I really don't think you'll see, though, is Fine Gael doing any deal with Sinn Féin, because they've made it clear that they aren't going to. So options are maybe Sinn Féin plus Fianna Fáil plus maybe another small party. There is another possibility of perhaps Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael doing some kind of a deal again, just like the outgoing government. But I think that's looking unlikely. I just don't think that the parties are up for doing that. And they think that they might be punished again by the electorate if they do. And then the other option, of course, is another election.
Which might be good for Sinn Féin, because they could stand some more candidates.
Quite.
Either way, it feels like this fits into a really strong tradition, European tradition of coalition agreements that go on forever. That's kind of what we do best in Europe. Naomi is one of the best island splainers in the business. If you're on Twitter, you should follow her there. She's also got a really good handle name, @NaomiOReally.
I resisted asking her about the implications for the upcoming B-word negotiations, which are going to be very, very important for Ireland, and because we don't talk about that on this podcast. But if you are interested in that, if you want to hear more of Naomi, then I can highly recommend her podcast with her friend Tim McInnery. Is that his name? McInnery?
I don't know how you pronounce it, but he's also my friend Tim, because Tim lives in Paris, and now you've outed me as not being able to pronounce his surname.
That's terrible, Katie. You're a terrible friend. Do you know how to pronounce my surname yet?
Sorry, Tim.
Anyway, it's called The Irish Passport, and they have great interviews and historical explainers, so check it out. It's time for a happy ending, the segment in which I try to find a story that will cheer us all up at the end of what is often a gloomy podcast.
Not so much this week, necessarily.
Not so much this week, that's true. But we could all do with more positive stories in our lives. So, hey.
Always.
I kind of just wanted to talk about how amazing Billie Eilish was for a few minutes after her incredible sweep of the Grammys last week. But Katie made a good point. She's not European and doesn't live here.
My other complaint is that you just want to talk about Billie Eilish so that you sound like a young person.
Well, I discovered her pretty late, let's be honest. I think she's been around for many years now and she's only just reached my consciousness in the last few months. But I have found a way to talk about her in Happy Ending in a European context. And that's thanks to a nice story I spotted on the BBC website about a Russian teenager from the small town of Tchaikovsky who has had some unexpected success due to some drawings she made of Billie. Nastya Kovton is 16 years old. She attended drawing school for a few years, but dropped out deciding it wasn't for her. Back in October, she joined Instagram to start showcasing some of her drawings, and two of them were of one of her favourite pop stars, the American teen superstar Billie Eilish. And they caught the attention of Eilish herself, who did that double-click likey thing.
Great young person reference.
It was a pretty big deal for Nastya, but she had no idea what was coming next. Flash forward a few months and Nastya receives a call from someone at Vogue. They say they want to feature one of her drawings on the cover of the digital edition of Vogue. Nastya was understandably skeptical and initially thought she was being pranked, but Vogue sent over more information by email and it turned out this was legit. Eilish had picked out Nastya's drawing and the drawing of one other woman, a woman in Michigan, to be featured in Vogue. So it's an amazing break for Nastya, who has seen a huge spike in interest online and is enjoying sharing her art with the world. She's also remained pretty level-headed about it all, which is quite sweet. She said to the BBC, "Art is not about catching the hype or getting rich. It's not about popularity or reward. You have to do what you love and always have to speak from the heart."
Ah,
happy ending.
So all we need is for like Europe's answer to Billie Eilish to do the double clicky likey thing on our podcast and then we'll become superstars. Who would that be? Maybe like Rosalia or someone.
Or Robin.
Oh, Robin. One of you. Get in touch.
Please do it. Or maybe we just need Nastya to draw our portraits. Although I think maybe she wouldn't find us as interesting to draw because we don't have green hair.
We could get that. That's doable. We've had a surge in really nice people signing up to support us on Patreon, Dominic.
We've used the word surge too many times this episode.
We've had an earthquake in people signing up.
Thank you, people, for joining us on Patreon. And you could join us too. Go to patreon.com/Europeans Podcast. Who are we thanking this week, Katie?
We have a very special thank you this week to our new Patreons, Lorenz Bogart, Jane Messenger, Oliver G., who's another amazing podcaster, by the way. Thanks, Oliver. Greta Bodomedi, Keelan Hunter, and the mysteriously one named Pietro.
Thank you, everyone. It's so nice.
We will be back with you next week. Till then, we're going to play you out with another track from Charlotte Dos Santos. Do give us a shout if you would like a chance to win the free tickets to her three shows. This is It's Over, Bobby. See you next week.